Now we'll discuss a few highlights of chapter 4 of the text, the chapter on perception. First thing we'll do is try a little magic trick. I'd like you to pick a card out of that list. Now make sure you memorize which card your card is. Better yet, on a piece of paper, write down the card. Got it? Okay, now think very, very hard about which card it was. Just mull the name over in your mind, and I'll try to guess what you chose. Or since I'm doing this earlier in time, I'll predict which one you will choose. Should be even harder. Okay, did I get it right? I should have taken your card out of the list. Is it there? We'll talk about that a little bit later. Perception and reasoning. Perception is related to reasoning in a lot of different ways. A few important ways are, first, the premises that we use in our arguments, we get that information, we get that evidence from perception more often than not. So if perception is faulty, then our reasoning is going to be faulty because the material, the information that we're using to reason with is not going to be reliable. Second, it turns out that the things that influence perception, the things that tend to make perception unreliable, things like our beliefs, desires, feelings, expectations, emotional states, all of those things tend to affect reasoning exactly the same way that they affect perception. A third, it's a good idea, it's good to be able to understand how perception works because perception is related to inductive reasoning. Perception goes, what we see is more than what's actually presented to us. And we'll see how that works in a little bit. Now with inductive reasoning, what we conclude is it goes beyond what the premises give us in terms of information. Okay, perception is selective. Some of that selectivity of our perception is hardwired into the brain. For instance, we can't hear sounds that are below a certain frequency or sounds that are above a certain frequency. So what we can hear is limited in ways. That's why we can't hear the dog whistle, but the dog can hear the dog whistle. Other examples are what we can see. The human sense perception systems can only see light that's within a certain spectrum, the visible spectrum, but we can't see things that are below the wavelength of red light or above the wavelength of violet light. So we don't see the infrared spectrum, we don't see the ultraviolet spectrum. Other examples are human beings and bats. Bats can perceive the world in different ways that we can. So given that we don't use a kind of echolocation, we can't perceive the world when there's not enough light the way that the bat can. Now, so that selectivity is built into us. Other selectivity is based on culture, expectations, beliefs, and desires. So this is not hardwired in the brain. This is sort of at the software level. Good example, and I think the text mentions this example, is when you go into a party, you hear a lot of noise, and you can't pick out any distinct sound. And suddenly you start talking to somebody, you start having a conversation, the noise level at the party seems to go down. That's because you're no longer concentrating on, you're concentrating on what the single person says, and your mind is then filtering out all the other noise. It's still there, but your mind's filtering it out for you. And then all of a sudden, somebody across the room speaks your name, and then you can't hear anything that person right in front of you is saying, but you hear everything that other person is saying. It's because you believe that, since they're talking about you, what they're saying is important, and therefore that belief tends to work as a filter. Back to perception and inference. A difference between deductively valid arguments and inductively strong arguments is that deductively valid arguments, in those valid arguments, the conclusion doesn't contain any more information than what was already in the premises. So consider the argument, all dogs are mammals, Lassie's a dog, therefore Lassie's a mammal. Now, what that conclusion says is already present in the premises. We just have to sort of pull it out of there. Now, given that the conclusion doesn't give us any more information than what is already contained in the premises, that's why it's impossible for the premises to be true and the conclusion false. In an inductively strong argument, though, the conclusion contains new information. What about an argument that says 99.9% of dogs bark, Lassie's a dog, therefore Lassie barks? Well, Lassie barking is not part of the premises. It's not contained in there, right? There's a little bit more information there. All we have in the premises is that 99.9% of dogs bark. Not all dogs bark, but most of them. So since the conclusion contains more information than what's in the premises, it's possible for the premises to be true and the conclusion false. Essentially, in inductively strong arguments, the conclusion goes beyond the information given in the premises. And perception works like that. In sense perception, in visual perception, let's talk about the premises being the input. Okay, so the image on the back of your retina, well, that's two-dimensional. It's upside down. It's punctate, which means that it's composed of a bunch of little dots with gaps in between. It moves around constantly because your eye is constantly jumping around, and it disappears and reappears. It disappears every time you blink and reappears whenever your eyes open back up. But what we see is not like that. What we see is three-dimensional. It's right side up. There are no gaps. It's stable and not disappearing and reappearing. Essentially, there's more to seeing than meets the eye. Now, here's an example. So we'll talk through this slowly so you have some time to do it. I have to warn you, if you're sitting in public, this is going to look kind of stupid. But what you need to do here is first close your left eye. Okay. And with your left eye closed, concentrate, focus with your right eye on that square that's to the left of the screen. And then as you have your left eye closed and you're focused on the square, move your head closer to the screen. And as you move your head closer to the screen, you should see that circle that's in your peripheral vision disappear. And then as you move it closer, it will reappear. And then move it back, it will disappear again and reappear. Now, what's going on here? Basically what happens is that your optic nerve is connected to your eyeball, and it's impossible for you to form an image right there at that spot where the optic nerve attaches. Now, why is it then that when you have the one eye closed that you don't see this gap? Okay, you don't see as you move closer, you don't see just a black spot there where there's no information. You see a continuous visual white field. That's because the mind is filling in the blanks. So there are all kinds of gaps in what we notice, but our mind fills in the details. Now, does it get it right? Sometimes. Does it get it wrong? Probably very often. Perceptual constancies are an example of things staying the same when they ought to be different. So stare at a picture on the wall. Walk closer to that picture, then walk backwards farther away. Well, the image on the back of the retina changes size. It gets bigger as you get closer. It gets smaller as you move farther away. But the perceived image, as long as you don't get too far away, the perceived image remains constant. Ambiguous figures are figures that can look like more than one thing. Okay, a classic example, well, there are a bunch of optical illusions that are examples of this. A classical example is the Necker cube. Necker cube is it's sort of a wireframe outline of a box. You've probably doodled these on papers during boring philosophy lectures in the past. So the interesting thing about a Necker cube is that you can at will change which face appears to be the front face of the box. So look at this example here on the slide. You can make those, as you scan around that example, you can see those boxes as either coming up out of the screen or going into the screen. Now, it's the same image on the screen, but there are different perceptions. Here's what these constancies and ambiguities tell us. Perceptual constancies, we have a different visual input, but we have the same visual output. We have different images on the back of the retina. We have the same perceived image in the mind. That tells us that identical input's not necessary for identical visual output. In an ambiguity, we've got exactly the same input, but we've got different output. That tells us that identical visual input's not sufficient for identical visual output. So we put those two together and we get identical input is neither necessary nor sufficient for identical output. What determines what we see? Well, a lot of things, not just the hardwired limitations in the brain, but also all of the social and cultural factors. What we see is at least partly determined by what we expect to see. And our expectations are determined at least partly by the context. So what we see is very, very strongly influenced by the context that we perceive it in. Here's an ambiguous figure. What's ambiguous about it? Well, it could be a bad drawing of a rabbit. If it is, the ears are to the left, his nose is to the right, and he's sort of looking down. Or it could be another bad drawing of a bird. If it's a bird, that's the back of his head to the right, he's looking up, and his beak is sort of up into the sky. So, what determines how we'll see this? Will we see it as a rabbit or a bird? Well, it depends on the context that we see it in. So if you see that figure on the in the setting on the left, a person's going to say, well, that's a group of rabbits. If we see the same figure in the setting on the right, the person's likely to perceive it as a bird. So how we perceive it is determined at least very strongly in part by the context in which we see it. So how would you imagine a person who hasn't really experienced very many birds but seen a lot of rabbits, how would they view that figure compared to the person who has seen not very many rabbits but a lot of birds? Here's another good example of an ambiguity. So we've got this figure here. What is it? Well, if we put it into a context and you ask a person what it is, here they'll just say it's a B, the letter B. If we place the same figure in a different context, people are inclined to see the number 13. Our perceptual set is the set of beliefs, emotions, expectations, desires, all these things that influence our perception. We call that a perceptual set. Now, the power of the perceptual set is demonstrated experimentally. Many, many experiments. And the book talks about a lot of those. Not just experiments, but anecdotal events like the people who shoot the tent thinking it's a bear because they're hunting bear. The example in the book about the Dartmouth-Princeton football game and asking the different fans which team was committed the most penalties, things like that. Other examples are the examples of the psychological experiment where the students are given alcohol, then placed in a stressful situation. And the students who are placed in the same stressful situation, not given alcohol, but given a placebo, but they're told that it's alcohol. And they have exactly the same reaction. So the belief that they had a drink that contained alcohol played a much larger role in determining how they will perceive the world than actually having the alcohol, and so on. So you can look at those examples in the text. Here are some other examples. There's a really interesting study, and it's sort of a You know, it's the kind of thing that you'd see in a candid camera show. But the experimenter came to walked up to a person in a public setting and asked them for directions to a particular building. And as this person is talking to the experimenter, some people were carrying this large door or sheet of plywood or something, but something that would completely block the person from view, and they walked right in between the two people. And what's going on is that there's another experimenter who's hiding behind that piece of plywood as they bring it into view. And as they get to the place there, the second experimenter takes the place of the first experimenter, who continues to walk on behind the sheet of plywood. So there's this switch of people, and they have different kinds of clothing on. They, you know, different heights, different weights. They look different, so on like that. But hardly anybody in the experiment who's explaining the directions, they don't even notice the switch. They don't even notice that there's a different person there that they're talking to. Another experiment is a example of changing the case on letters. So the reason that a visual image jumps around at the back of the retina is because our eyes are constantly moving. And so experimenters have developed ways to test to see when your eye is no longer focused on what you're seeing, that it's jumping around, and so on. And they set up this experiment so that when a person would look away, then suddenly they would change the case of the letters of the text that's on the on a particular screen. And then when they do that back and forth, when the person's eye would look away again, they would quickly change the case back. And again, no one notices that this is going on. So the question is, would we know the difference when we're presented with this? Well, go back to the card experiment. If you look at the not the experiment, but the magic trick that we did at the beginning, where I picked your card and took it away from the list, here are the two sets of cards that I gave you. If you'll notice, no card in the second list is the same as the card in the first list. So it didn't matter which card you chose. It's guaranteed that that card's not going to be in the second list. The point is that we really don't notice things. In fact, if we're not concentrating on what it is, we really don't notice what's going on. So in a particular situation, it may be the case that we do, in fact, notice a feature of a situation. We're concentrating on that, but our mind is filling in all the gaps of the things that we're really not paying close attention to. And sometimes those things that we don't pay close attention to prove out to be in later situations really important. For example, you're a witness to a crime, you didn't realize it was crime, and suddenly you're asked to pick the criminal out of the lineup. Well, if you weren't paying close attention to who that person was at the time, then it's not very likely that you'll get it right, for instance. Now, you'll remember something, but it may be the case that your mind is just filling that in for you. So, to sum up, here's what we know about perception and a little bit of why it's related to good reasoning skills. We try to make the world and our encounter with the world come out to be coherent, fit an organized, coherent pattern. And when we do that, we try to fit the things that we see and hear into that pattern in a way that it'll fit that pattern. Now, it may be that the way we set up the pattern is sort of biased in the first place. So we perceive things not the way that they are, but in a way that will fit this story that we've constructed for the world. Second thing is that reliable perception requires very, very close attention to what's going on. And in the same way, we'll find out later that reliable reasoning requires very, very close attention to the details. In order to reason well, we have to reason with our mind actively engaged.